Hi, I'm Daniel Lenzian, host of Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studio. Western New York Soundstage is a podcast that looks to explore Western New York's creative economy through a series of conversations with artists, musicians, producers, directors, and authors from Western New York and beyond. Today, I speak with Darren Cotton, the executive director of the Tool Library and founder and principal designer of Do Good Design. According to their website, the Buffalo Tool Library is a place where community members can borrow tools for set periods of time at a low cost. It is an example of a real sharing economy, a neighborhood-focused non-for-profit network where community members can share practical resources in centralized space. The Tool Library is a social enterprise model and represents the work of people in the neighborhood coming together to share resources and knowledge, reduce waste, and lower barriers to access. Darren Cotton is powerfully committed to the city of Buffalo and urban planning. We discuss the need for community, the funding of nonprofit institutions, and the positive impact the Tool Library has had on Buffalo. Darren, thank you so much for talking to me today. How are you?
I'm great. How are you? Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. I'm very well. So you do so many things and you're connected to so many organizations. If you were to meet someone at a party, how would you describe what you do?
That is a great question. I'm sort of all over the place. I will really credit, I would say, my grad work in urban planning for getting me engaged in so many things across the city of Buffalo. But if I had to choose like three major categories, which in my email signature, I say urban planner, graphic designer, and tool librarian. So I think that kind of covers the spectrum of projects more or less.
Fantastic. Now, according to the research, you have a degree in linguistics and a master's degree in urban planning. How did you decide on those educational pursuits?
I think like most seniors in high school, having no idea what you want to do with the rest of your life, I was just looking at like, what do I enjoy? What was I good at? And I really loved writing. I really loved language. And so that kind of led me in my undergrad to study international studies and linguistics. And then in my junior year, kind of realizing, okay, how do I actually find gainful employment in either of those fields? And it was actually studying abroad that kind of introduced me to the field of urban planning before I even knew what that was really. So I think it was really just seeing different ways of building communities and different ways of imagining transportation. And so that really got me interested in, you know, if this is how I was studying in the south of France, you know, if this is how one country is kind of building their communities, like, what are the lessons that we can learn? How can I bring that back to Buffalo? So that really led me to pursue a master's degree in urban planning. You know, I think Buffalo is sort of a crucible of different planning techniques for better or for worse. But I think especially in the past 10 years, you know, we've seen some really incredible progress made just both with new initiatives and then trying to sort of, I think, repair mistakes made in the past.
You said you studied in France. What was something that you saw there, perhaps, that you said, oh, I've got to bring this back home?
Being able to live without a car, I think, would be number one. So the host family that I was staying with was probably, you know, I would say 6 or 7 miles away from the school that I was going to. And it was just super easy to jump on a tram and then take that to the city center and go be able to walk to the school. And this was back in 2010, 2011. So they also had a super robust bike share program. And this was before, you know, any major metropolitan area in the States were even thinking about things like bike share. So it really got me thinking about what do we need to build, you know, productive and accessible communities where everyone kind of has access to what they need to live a really meaningful life.
We've mentioned urban planning a little bit for people who might be encountering this podcast for the first time and don't know what it is. Could you explain what it is and say how it affects the lives of Buffalonians?
Yeah, absolutely. The thing I love most about urban planning, I think, is just the fact that it is so interdisciplinary. So it's like one part sociology, one part architecture, one part design. So it's really understanding, you know, how people interact with the built environment, whether that is housing, parks, transportation, and kind of understanding those relationships and figuring out, you know, how best can we invest public resources and invest in public infrastructure to improve people's everyday lives?
Is there a story from your early life that when you look back on it, you say that makes you say, oh, I see how I ended up on this career path?
I am still kind of trying to figure that out, like what led me to want to go into these fields. I think it's interesting, you know, my father grew up on the east side of Buffalo. My mother grew up in West Seneca. They purchased a home out in Colden, which is like ski country. So it was sort of like this really interesting back to the city movement for me, where it's like, you know, they basically got as far from the city as possible. And I did the exact opposite. And I think just living off campus in University Heights, being able to walk and bike places really just introduced me to a totally different way of living. And then finding out that there was, you know, an actual field of study and profession that was really focused on that, I just found super interesting.
Your work seems very community-minded and locally based. Could you speak on if concepts like local and community are important to you?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think that really comes back to, I lived on campus my first year at UB and then quickly moved off campus to a house off of UB's South Campus. And for me, it really was like being able to meet people, like feeling like I was part of a broader community beyond just campus. So I started attending some monthly community meetings. The University Heights Collaborative was sort of my first foray into that, where it was just, you know, people coming together of their own free will, you know, sharing issues, challenges on their streets, on their blocks, and then just trying to develop solutions to those as just kind of an all-volunteer organization of people. And so that was, again, like super interesting to me. How do we as community members, as citizens of Buffalo, you know, come together and sort of organize to address issues that we're facing on an everyday basis? You know, unfortunately, the city of Buffalo can't do everything. I think they have been very resource constrained for many decades. And so how can we as individuals and as communities come together to solve some of these issues?
What's the origin of the tool library?
So again, living off campus in a not so lovely apartment and having a not so responsive landlord kind of led me to want to just do like small projects around the apartment, fix things up, you know, do some basic painting, just, you know, try to improve my living space. And as a college student, not necessarily having the tools or the means to buy the tools to do a lot of that work got me super interested in, okay, well, if I'm experiencing these challenges and I'm coming from a place of, you know, relative privilege, I can only imagine like what that experience is for, you know, renters kind of across the city. So that really led me to look into, okay, what's a very like tangible on the ground solution to this? And tool libraries sort of came up in conversation at the time. Push Buffalo and Buffalo Reuse were both looking at the idea. There was a lot of great resources online. I stumbled upon a Google group, which is still super active in 2023. I don't know if anyone even remembers Google groups anymore, but it was this amazing resource of just like people sharing information. Like that's where we were able to get a lot of our starting, just like documentation, how to start the organization, what membership looks like, you know, borrowing rules. So again, it was like this very beautiful example of sharing, the sharing economy, and how people were just really open to the idea of, if you want to start this in your community, like here is everything that you need to do that. Found those resources, worked with a friend who was getting his MBA at UB, put together a pretty basic business plan of what a tool library could look like in Buffalo, and specifically based in University Heights. Was able to get some startup funding from the city of Buffalo, the council person at the time. Found a storefront, bought, you know, probably 24 tools. And that was back in May of 2011. So here we are 12 years later. We've got about 1,150 active members at this point and an inventory of about 4,000 tools. So we really have come quite a ways over those past 12 years. And for the first 10, that was just all volunteer run, which again, I think is super incredible and speaks to just Buffalo's tradition and culture of civic engagement.
Why would you say to someone that an organization like this is important to a city like Buffalo?
I think there's so many angles you can come at this from. For us, it was really about accessibility. So the idea that just because you can't afford something doesn't mean that you shouldn't have access to it. And so resources like the tool library are a really great example, I think, to provide sort of equitable access to things that a lot of us might take for granted. So again, thinking about being able to mow your lawn, you know, lawnmowers can be super expensive. And again, for those who are renting and don't have a super responsive landlord, and maybe they want to be able to take a more active role in that, you know, being able to borrow a lawnmower. And membership starts as low as $30 a year. So they would be able to borrow that, use that, bring it back. I think really just begins to change the conversation about equity and access in the city. And as a city that I think struggles with those issues, given what we've seen over the past year, especially, I think sharing is a really great way to begin to address that, you know, both at the policy level, but also at a very tangible neighborhood level as well.
Is the membership fee on a sliding scale?
So the way we have it structured, there's three tiers, and that is really based on people's ability to support us. So membership starts at $30 a year, and then it's $75 and $150. And then those higher tiers also allow you to take out more tools. So again, we do a lot of work with like other nonprofits and block clubs, organizations. So you know, if they're hosting a tree planting or cleanup, chances are they need like, you know, 40, 50 tools all at once. So they're able to purchase that higher tiered membership that helps support us. And, but again, like our challenge is always like, okay, how do we sustain ourselves as a nonprofit organization? But how do we continue to make our services accessible? So I'm really happy that last year we were given an unsolicited grant from the Borenstein Family Foundation that allowed us to roll out membership scholarships. So again, for anyone where $30 may be a barrier to being able to join the tool library, we do have scholarship memberships available. So we want everyone to have access to the tool library. So if that is something that people are interested in, it's right on our website, just a short form that they would fill out, or they can just come into the shop and we're happy to kind of walk them through that process.
You mentioned grants, and I know from my line of work that an economic driver for nonprofits is grant writing. For those that don't know, what is grant writing? How does it work? I guess maybe what's the best part and the worst part of grant writing?
Yeah, this was honestly one of the skills that I really wanted to get out of my university education, and is not something, it's kind of difficult to teach, I would say, in a classroom setting. Because it very much is dependent on like, what's the context, what's the project. But in a lot of ways for me, I think grant writing is a lot of just storytelling. And so like, you know, what is the project? What is the impact? How will that really touch people's lives? And I think, you know, at its most foundational element, that really is what grant writing is. But then you begin to have to build in sort of those technical pieces as well. So thinking about a budget, thinking about timelines, what are your milestones? I mean, I still continue to learn more about grant writing every time I do it. And it really is just something that you kind of just have to jump into. And it's like, you know, I wrote my first grant when I was still in school, and it was a very small grant. It was $1,000, but just like the rush of actually getting that funding is pretty, pretty addicting. So you kind of just want to continue to do it and continue to kind of hone those skills. But yeah, it's sort of just like, what is that impact that you're hoping to make, and how can you kind of share that story with the funders and make that convincing argument that your project should be funded?
I think storytelling is so important for human beings. I'm a theater professor, and so my whole life is kind of telling stories. I would be so interested to know if there's a story from your experience at the Tool Library that you could share that you really, that you know, goes on your grants, or that you feel like, wow, this is something that's really incredible, or something that I saw, or something that was built, or something that was created through the Tool Library.
One project that I always come back to, and I don't think the Tool Library can take complete credit for it, but I think was a really important part of it, was actually the construction of the North Buffalo Rail Trail. For those that aren't familiar, It's about a mile long multi-use trail that runs from the LaSalle Park and Ride Station to Kenmore Avenue, where it picks up Tonawanda's rail trail and runs all the way up to the canal. So that for a long time was just sort of this overgrown abandoned rail right away, a gravel path, lots of illegal dumping, lots of crime, lots of illicit activities. You know, you would get people hiking or dog walkers, but it was just not a very nice place for the community. And it was connected to this other smaller neighborhood park called Minnesota Linear Park, which again, I think had sort of fallen out of use, had been neglected, not invested in, seen a lot of illegal dumping. And through the University Heights Collaborative and a number of the block clubs, they were just kind of like, you know, enough is enough. This is our neighborhood park. So they started organizing cleanup on a pretty regular basis. And we were able to assist, obviously, with the tools, but being a UB student, a UB alum, and then at the time also a UB staff person, connecting sort of those cleanups to student-run organizations, different initiatives that the university were running. So it went from cleanups, you know, that had four or five people, most of whom were over the age of 65, to cleanups that, you know, had 50, 60 people. You know, we had athletes from UB like carrying out 100-pound, you know, debris, and just so really making a significant impact. And I think, again, it was just kind of this contagious momentum of, wow, we've accomplished so much and what else can we do? And in that process of cleaning up this park and sort of advocating to the city, realizing that the city had been sitting on about $1.2 million of federal funding that had specifically been earmarked to transform that corridor into a rail trail project. So we were able to kind of leverage that grassroots cleanup project into this full-blown advocacy project. We had people going door to door. I think the final tally was about 3,000 petitions signed of people saying, you know, we want to see this piece of infrastructure built in our backyard. We want to see that money invested. We think this will be a transformative project. And literally, I think it was 3 months before the funding was set to expire and be recaptured by the federal government. The city of Buffalo was able to sign a long-term lease with the NFTA, which owned that property, and begin construction on the rail trail. So between 2015 and 2016, they completed construction. And now, you know, I would say it's probably the number one asset of University Heights and of North Buffalo. You know, we've run numerous community surveys, and it's always walkability, accessibility, the rail trail, having access to those sorts of green spaces, and walking and biking infrastructure that people list as like the number one reason why they chose to live in this community. So again, you know, the tool library played a very small part in that, but I think just by giving communities the tools that they need, they can sort of turn these ideas and transform these spaces that they have all these dreams for into, you know, actual tangible projects that can really impact people's lives on a regular basis.
I just keep going back to the image of sort of seniors working alongside of students and athletes. And I think that that's so incredible. And what an amazing community that this project brought together. What kind of community has formed around the Tool Library?
Yeah, that is, I would say, probably one of my favorite things about the Tool Library is that it brings so many different people together. You know, just from a membership standpoint, it's really interesting to kind of look at a map of where all our members are coming from. So we've got about 60 different zip codes represented in people that are members of the Tool Library. So, you know, you've got people from Broadway Fillmore, you've got people from the Elmwood Village, you've got people from South Buffalo, you've got people as far south as like Springville, you've got people from Niagara Falls. So I think, again, just from like a diversity standpoint and thinking about how the Tool Library is sort of used and envisioned by so many different people. So it's like, you know, someone maybe is starting a small urban farm. Someone has just purchased their first home and they're fixing it up. Someone's on a limited budget and, you know, they're trying to start a backyard garden. So just like those diversity of experiences is really incredible. And then just from a standpoint of our volunteers, so again, we still very much are volunteer powered. We've got UB students. We just started a work study pilot program where we actually have students who are placed with us. And so they're paid through the university, but are also kind of helping us staff the shop. And they've said overwhelmingly that it has just been a great opportunity for them to get out of the classroom, get off of campus, and, you know, apply their skills, apply what they're passionate about to things that are happening out in the community. So that, again, you know, I will always be kind of a UB alum. And I think UB is such an incredible asset, and especially students are an incredible asset that I think sometimes we don't necessarily think about. And unfortunately, in University Heights, there is just kind of this negative perception that I feel like I've always been battling against from when I was a student, and just being like, hey, I'm also a student, and I am not, you know, trying to wreak havoc. Like, I want a meaningful relationship with community members, and figuring out, you know, how can I apply my skills and my talents to things that we collectively want to see accomplished. So I do, you know, civic engagement, I think, is just one of the foundational pieces of the tool library, and that it allows so many different people to be in one space.
I think that if I were a member of the tool library, I would definitely use it to hang blinds, which always seems to sort of be my nemesis. And it seems like you definitely have the equipment to do that. But I'm wondering, if people wanted to do some sort of a more creative project, build a bench or something like that, does the tool library have the tools to help them get that done?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I mentioned, we've got an inventory of about 4,000 tools, and that ranges anywhere from basic hand tools, you know, hammers, wrenches, screwdrivers, all the way up to things like chop saws, circular saws, drills, pressure washers, lawn mowers, weed whackers, wheelbarrows, ladders. Really, our only constraint at this point is space. Like, we're running out of space. But yeah, our entire inventory is online. So if people visit us at thetoollibrary.org, they can actually search the entire inventory. So if there's a particular item that they know that they'll need and they don't want to go out to a big box store and drop $200, like, definitely check our inventory first. And we're always looking to add things. So we've been really lucky that we've got sponsorships from tool manufacturers. We've been funded by the M&T Foundation, who will provide funding for us to go out and buy things. So we've got sort of a running tool wish list of items that we don't yet have, but would love to add. And yeah, so for your most basic DIY projects, chances are we've got what you need.
Are there classes or events at the tool library?
Not yet. So that is something that we did do. But during COVID, the space that we were using kind of as a flex space, workshop, classroom, we ended up transforming into kind of like a contactless pickup and drop off room. And then just due to the growth of membership, so over 2020, we saw an increase of about 45% of our membership. So we went from like 600 members to over 1,000. We just had to kind of commandeer that space for more tool storage, which again is a great problem to have, but now we don't have any on-site space to host those workshops. But 2023, we are looking ideally to partner with some other organizations to have kind of quarterly workshops, because again, you know, we can certainly provide the tools, but we also want to provide people that knowledge and that confidence that they need to tackle something that maybe they've never done. And personally, like I always say, I'm probably the last person that should have started a tool library. I don't come from a family of contractors or carpenters. You know, my exposure to building things was my middle school shop class, which I did love. But, you know, I've learned so much over the past 12 years of, I remember when we first opened, and it's like loaning things out that I myself did not know how to use. And it's like, I mean, you can go on YouTube, I don't know, to like being at a place where now I feel pretty confident of like walking people through 95% of what we have in the inventory, and just seeing them, you know, walking through that process and seeing that confidence in other people is super encouraging as well.
What is your ultimate dream or vision for the Chul Library?
So I guess like one of our dream projects, something that we've identified in our strategic plan, is to actually own our location. So right now we are renting Ideally, in the next year, we will find a larger rental location, but our long-term plan really is to either purchase a property or build new. And I'm really inspired by organizations like the Massachusetts Avenue Project and their farmhouse that they've built, and just seeing that how they've been able to welcome so many more people into the work that they're doing, to have a resource center, to have a commercial kitchen. Similarly for us, I would love for us to have a workshop space. That's another thing that we get lots of requests for, members who are like, well, I don't really want to take, a table saw home. Can I just like rip stuff down at your location? And it's like, well, not at this point, not safely, but would love to have kind of, those things that aren't loaned out that are available for people to use sort of in-house, and just to make that more accessible. And again, I think just broaden what we are able to do kind of on that sharing economy basis. So one project that we're hoping to get off the ground this year as well, is a lead hazard reduction tool borrowing program. So we have been chatting with the Erie County Department of Health. They run some really fantastic workshops around how to safely remediate lead-based paint in your homes. So getting certified to do that. But one of the challenges is, a HEPA vac is one of the key tools for that, and those start anywhere from like $500 to $1,000. But for someone that's looking to do this work themselves, that is a huge barrier to be able to do it safely. So we've gotten funding to purchase two HEPA vacs, and we really want to get that project off the ground, working with homeowners who have gone through the training and really just need access to those tools. And again, it's thinking about, these issue-based initiatives where lead-based paint is still a huge issue in Buffalo, and lead poisoning is a huge issue. So how can we use a model like the tool library? It's not going to solve the issue, but it's going to be a piece of a much broader approach to eliminating that as a concern, and as something that affects people every day.
Where is it, the tool library?
We are right off of Main Street near UB South Campus. The address is 5 West Northrop Place. So if people know Parkside Candy with that big neon sign, we are literally one block south of that, right around the corner on West Northrop Place.
I just have a couple other questions for you about your other work. So I can sort of see the inspiration from linguistics in your design company. I think I'm saying it correctly, but forgive me because the umlaut could throw me. Do good design, is that correct?
That is absolutely correct.
Cool. So Do Good Design, what a fantastic name. And it really connects to all of the work that you're doing and trying to do good. What was the origin for Do Good Design?
So, like a lot of other things I do, like everything is interconnected. So it really came out of my work at the Tool Library, and then also with the University Heights Collaborative. Again, I think there are these grassroots all-volunteer organizations that are doing really fantastic work. But of course, they don't have the funding to hire a graphic designer to like communicate what that work is. And that was just something that I always loved. Even growing up, I was always messing around in Photoshop and building websites, and it was just something that I loved. And I realized once I got into planning school, like how important graphic design, and to me, I think of it more as like communication design, how important that can be to convey, really complex or really difficult concepts into something that is much more consumable and something that people can understand, sort of developing, these calls to action. So the Tool Library and the UHC really provided me an opportunity to kind of develop those skills and use those in a community context, and how important that can be to getting messages out, and just sort of pushing projects forward. So being able to take that and apply that to other projects and working with other nonprofits and really working on, initiatives and projects that I care about and that I feel like are making a meaningful contribution to Buffalo and Western New York has been just a really wonderful opportunity. And I continue similarly to the tool library, like I'm learning something new every day on how, design really can be harnessed in so many different ways to really push forward any number of things. So, whether it's like I think back to the rail trail, like being able to design social media graphics for that and being able to design handouts. And just being able to really communicate with people. And the tool library was an opportunity. Like, I had never taken a formal class in like branding or marketing, but like basically building a brand from the ground up and how important that is, and the use of color. Like, Tool Library teal is sort of our signature look. So, you know, learning those things through experience has just been really fun. And I'm really glad that I get to bring that to other projects.
Is there a favorite campaign that you've worked on?
Favorite campaign, I would say when I was working at the University District Community Development Association, we were looking at, so the rail trail was this huge success, but people were like, okay, well, how do we expand it? How do we bring that across Main Street into, you know, Buffalo's east side and connect it into some of this other existing infrastructure? So we launched the Northeast Greenway Initiative. So really looking at, there's about a mile gap between where the rail trail ends, and then at Kensington and William Gator, there's another dedicated walking and cycling path. So how do we connect those two pieces and really kind of developing a graphic identity around that, and using that for surveys and using that for lawn signs to actually get input from users of those spaces, what they wanted to see, how those spaces could be improved. So that is, I would say, one of the things I love most about design is like seeing it in situ, like seeing how it's actually impacting those spaces.
All of your work in some way is interdisciplinary and creatively driven. How does creativity fuel the work you do?
I would say, I think what I, how I always approach things is like, how can we do things differently and how can we improve upon things that have already been done? Like, at the end of the day, I don't want what I'm doing just to be a regurgitation of what has been done time and time again. And I think, you know, collectively as a society, we sort of owe that to ourselves, to continue to progress and like think about new ways of doing things. And I think technology, for all its flaws, really gives us an opportunity to reimagine how we're doing things and to really push the boundaries of, you know, what it means to be an active citizen and what it means to be a participant in society. And so creativity obviously is such a huge part of that. And I think it's really interesting to see sort of the conversations around AI, art, and, you know, this new like chat GPT or whatever, that's like writing term papers and haikus and things. And it's like, you know, people really worrying about that being the death of human creativity. And I think, you know, it is but another tool for us to continue to progress and kind of, you know, use it in a meaningful way, but still continue. Like, I don't think there will ever be a substitute for human creativity. So I haven't dived into either of those tools. But again, I just think, you know, creativity is at the heart of so much of what we do. And it really is, it's a challenge that we need to hold ourselves to.
As an urban planner, I'm sure that you may have sort of a dream or a vision for the city of Buffalo. If you feel comfortable, would you share that, a part of that, with us?
I think for me, obviously, as an urban planner, I think there has been a lot of really unfortunate things done over the course of the past 50, 60, 70 years. And unfortunately, a lot of that at the hands of urban planners and transportation engineers and policymakers. So something like the Kensington Expressway, you know, the destruction of Humboldt Parkway in my lifetime, I would love to see that filled in, and I would love to see the parkway restored. And I think similar to that, I would love to see the metro expanded out to North Campus and beyond. Again, I think like transportation, and this like brings me back to studying abroad, like the ability, travel and mobility and accessibility are all super critical to people being able to live meaningful lives and being able to feel like they are self-determined when you're not saddled, you know, with a $15,000 expense every year of private automobile ownership. So I think the more accessible we can make the region, the more everyone can thrive. And it's sort of just like, I know there's a lot of Bills fans out there, but it's just mind-boggling to think $1 billion for a stadium for a profit-driven team versus like what $1 billion could do if invested into things like public infrastructure and honestly just like basic infrastructure like sidewalks. I would love to see the city of Buffalo develop a comprehensive sidewalk plan, including, you know, snow clearance of sidewalks. Again, coming back to this issue of equity. So we have snow plows to clear the streets, but for those who don't own cars, sidewalks are their only alternative. So the fact that that is not a publicly provided service is kind of mind-boggling. But yeah, so I guess I am being a little urban planning-y by focusing so much on transportation, but I think all of those things could be really transformative if they were to happen.
We've talked so much about being kind of local and based in Buffalo. And so I'd love to just ask, what's the best part of living in Buffalo?
The fact that I was like a grad student and I was able to start a nonprofit organization, I was able to start the Tool Library, and the affordability that Buffalo, I think, provides really is becoming more and more scarce, I think, across the country, where if you have a dream or you have an idea, whether or not you have the means to actually realize that is becoming increasingly unaffordable to do. I guess that would be one of my like worries about Buffalo, though, is that becoming too expensive, that is no longer, you know, people are no longer able to articulate their dreams there. I don't think we're quite there yet. And I think there are steps that we can take to prevent that. But there's just so much space for people to be able to do the things that they care about and that they're passionate about. And that's one thing, like as an urban planner, seeing all of these organizations and growing up in a Buffalo, you know, I did not know the Buffalo of my parents' generation. I think it was a very different place. All I've ever seen is just people being able to take sort of an active role in improving their neighborhood or improving the city as a whole. And that's like what I love, just so many amazing nonprofit organizations. I think even in response to, you know, this latest blizzard, you know, mutual aid and the amount of just individuals who are able to step up and kind of fill those gaps. That is just like Buffalo, I think, in a nutshell.
Well, Darren, thank you very much for your time today. It was really wonderful talking to you. I always like to say at the end of my interviews, or sort of just ask the person that's been nice enough to sit with me for a number of minutes, do you feel like there's anything we've missed, or is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners before we go?
I guess one thing that I'll share, and I will say like my understanding of like the work that we're doing at the Tool Library, I think continues to grow and evolve every year. You know, as I continue to read and learn more about like other sort of things that are happening, you know, both locally and globally, but things like, you know, the rise of mutual aid, and some people call it the solidarity economy, I think really challenging ourselves to reimagine what the economy can look like in this country and globally as we're faced with all of these growing crises like global warming. I think it's pretty clear that the system we have is not working. And so really reimagining what economies can look like, and the Tool Library being a really wonderful hyperlocal example of let's build things around this idea of abundance and there is plenty if we share, and less around scarcity and competition. Because I think the future really is collaborative and cooperative. And so, you know, whether it's the Tool Library or whether it's a worker-owned co-op or whether it's these mutual aid efforts that we're seeing just sort of organically sort of arise in response to crises, like how can we as individuals, but also as a society, support those sorts of things? Because funding is so critical. And as a nonprofit, grant writing is really difficult. And the more time you spend writing grants and the more time you spend reporting out on grants, that's less time that you're spending actually accomplishing your mission. I could probably do an entire another interview just on that, but I will leave it there.
Maybe we'll put it in the books. We'll put it on the schedule. Darren, it was really great talking to you today. Thank you so much for chatting. And well, we'll see you soon. We'll see you at the Tool Library.
Yeah, absolutely. Would love it.
Well, that's our show for today. It was great to speak to Darren about the Tool Library. I'm thrilled that this institution is in Buffalo and that it continues to flourish. If you live in the city of Buffalo, please consider joining or volunteering at the Tool Library. Thanks from Western New York Soundstage and Buffalo Rising. Today's show is produced by Jessica Marinelli. Addison Schoonmaker engineered this episode. make sure you subscribe to the show. If you like the show, please recommend it to a friend. In addition to this podcast, you can check out our local events guide, posted bi-monthly at buffalorising.com. We'll be back soon with more episodes where we will explore our local creative economy through a series of conversations with artists, musicians, producers, directors, and authors from Western New York and beyond. Thanks for listening to Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studio.